Chapter 15. While the two girls still crouched in the bushes with their hands over their faces, they heard the voice of the witch calling out, "Now follow me all, and we will all set about what remains of this war. It will not take us long to crush the human vermin and the traitors now that the great fool, the great cat, lies dead." At this moment, the children were for a few seconds in very great danger. For with wild cries and a noise of gurgling pipes and shrill horns blowing, the whole of that vile rabble came sweeping off the hilltop and down the slope right past their hiding place. They felt the specters go by them like a cold wind, and they felt the ground shake beneath them under the galloping feet of the minotaurs. Overhead went a flurry of foul wings and a blackness of vultures and giant bats. At any other time, they would have trembled with fear, but now the sadness and shame and horror of Aslan's death so filled their minds that they hardly thought of it. As soon as the wood was quiet and silent again, Susan and Lucy crept out into the open hilltop. The moon was getting low and thin clouds were passing across her, but still they could see the shapes of the lion lying dead in his bonds. Down they both knelt in the wet grass and kissed his cold face and stroked his beautiful fur, at least what was left of it, and cried till they could cry no more. Then they looked at each other and held each other's hands for mere loneliness and cried again. Then again they were silent. At last, Lucy said, "I can't bear to look at that horrible muzzle. I wonder, could we take it off?" So they tried. After a lot of working at it, for their fingers were cold and it was now the darkest part of the night, they finally succeeded. When they saw his face without it, they burst out crying again and kissed it and fondled it and wiped away the blood and foam as well as they could. It was all more lovely and hopeless and horrid than I know how to describe. "I wonder, could we untie him as well?" Susan asked presently, but the enemies, out of pure spitefulness, had drawn the cord so tight that the girls could make nothing of the knots. "I hope no one who reads this book has been quite as miserable as Lucy and Susan were that night. But if you had been, if you'd been up all night and cried till you had no more tears left in you, you will know that it comes to the end of a sort of quietness. You feel as if nothing was ever going to happen again. At any rate, that was how it felt to those two. Hours and hours seemed to go by in this dead calm. They hardly noticed they were getting colder and colder. But at last Lucy noticed two other things. One was that the sky on the east side of the hill was a little less dark than it had been an hour ago. The other was some tiny movement going on in the grass at her feet. At first she took no interest in this. What did it matter? Nothing mattered now. But at last she saw whatever it was had begun to move up the upright stones of the stone table. Whatever they were moving along on Aslan's body. She looked closer. They were little gray things. "Ugh," said Susan from the other side of the table. "How beastly. They're horrid little mice crawling all over them. Get away, you little beast," and she raised her hand to frighten them away. "Wait," said Lucy, who had been looking at them more closely still. "Can you see what they're doing?" Both girls then bent down and stared.
I do believe," said Susan, "but how queer. They're nibbling away at the cords."
"That's what I thought," Lucy said. I think they're friendly mice. Poor little things, they don't realize that he's dead. They think it'll do some good untying him." It was quite definitely lighter by now. Each of the girls noticed for the first time the white face of the other. They could see the mice nibbling away, dozens and dozens, possibly even hundreds, of little field mice. At last, one by one, the ropes were all gnawed through. The sky in the east was whitish by now, and the stars were getting fainter, all except one very big one low down in the eastern horizon. They felt colder than they had been all night. Finally, the mice crept away again. The girls cleared away what remained of the gnawed ropes. Aslan looked more like himself without them. Every moment, his dead face looked nobler,
as the light grew and they could see it better. In the wood behind them, a bird gave a chuckle sound. It had been so still for hours and hours that it had startled the girls. Then another girl answered it. Soon there were birds singing all over the place. It was finally quite definitely morning, and not late night. "I'm so cold," Lucy said. "So am I," Susan responded. "Let's walk around a bit." They walked to the eastern edge of the hill and looked down. The one big star had almost disappeared by now. The country all looked dark gray, but beyond, at the very end of the world, the sea showed pale. The sky began to turn red, and they walked to and fro more times than they could count between the dead Aslan and the eastern ridge, trying to keep warm. Oh, how tired their legs felt. Then at last, as they stood for a moment looking out toward the sea in Cair Paravel, which they could just now make out, the red turned to gold along the line where the sea and the sky met, and very slowly up came the edge of the sun. At that moment, they heard from behind them a loud noise, a great cracking, deafening noise of a giant, as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. "What was that?" Lucy asked, clutching Susan's arm. I'm afraid to turn around," Susan said. "Something awful's happening." "They're doing something worse to him," said Lucy. "Come on," and she turned, pulling Susan around with her. The rising of the sun had made everything look so different. All of the colors and shadows had changed, that for a moment they didn't see the most important thing. Then they did. The stone table was broken into two pieces by a great crack that ran down it from end to end. And there was no Aslan. "Oh!" Both girls cried, rushing back and forth to the table. "Oh, this is too bad," Lucy sobbed. "They might have left his body alone." "Who could have done this?" Susan cried. "What does it mean? Is this more magic?" "Yes," said a great voice behind their backs. "It is more magic." They looked around. There, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, for it had apparently grown back, stood Aslan himself. "Oh, Aslan!" both of the children cried, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. "Aren't you dead then, dear Aslan?" Lucy asked. "No, not now," said Aslan. "You're not a... asked Susan in a shaky voice. She couldn't bring herself to say the word ghost. Aslan stooped his golden head and licked her forehead. The warmth of his breath and a rich sort of smell that seemed to hang about his hair came all over him. Her. "Do I look it?" he asked. "Oh, you're real, you're real. Oh, Aslan," Lucy cried, and both girls flung themselves up against him and covered him with kisses. "But what does this mean?" Susan asked when they were both somewhat calmer. "It means," said Aslan, "that though the White Witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time. But if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack, and death itself would start working backwards. And now..." Yes, now," said Lucy, jumping up, clapping her hands. "Oh, children," said the lion, "I feel my strength coming back to me. Catch me if you can." He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. Then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table. Laughing, though she didn't know why, Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leapt again. The mad chase then began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them up in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them, now stopping unexpectedly so all three of them rolled over together in a happy laughing heap of fur, arms, and legs. It was such a romp that as no one has ever had expected in Narnia. Whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. The funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. "And now," said Aslan presently, "to business. I feel I'm going to roar. You had better put your fingers in your ears." And they did. Aslan stood up, and when he opened his mouth to roar, his face became so terrible that they dared not look at it. They saw all the trees in front of them bend before the blast of his roar, as grass bends in the meadow before a wind. Then he said, "We have a long journey to go. You must ride on me." He crouched down, and the children climbed onto his warm, golden back. Susan sat first, holding on tightly to his mane, and Lucy sat behind, holding on tightly to Susan. With a great heave, he rose underneath them and then shot off, faster than a horse could go, downhill and into the thick of the forest. That ride was perhaps the most wonderful thing that had happened to them in Narnia. Have you ever had a gallop on a horse? Think of that, and then take away the heavy noise of the hooves and the jingle of the bits, and imagine instead the almost noiseless padding of the great paws. Then imagine instead of the black or gray or chestnut back of the horse, the soft roughness of golden fur, and the mane flying back in the wind. Then imagine you're going about twice as fast as the fastest racehorse. But this is a mount that doesn't need to be guided and never grows tired. He rushes on and on, never missing his footing, never hesitating, threading his way with perfect skill between tree trunks, jumping over bush and briar and the small streams, wading the larger, swimming the largest of all. And you're not right. You're riding not on a road, nor in a park, nor even in the downs, but right across Narnia in spring, down solemn avenues of beech and across sunny glades of oak, through wild orchards of snow-white cherry trees, past roaring waterfalls and mossy rocks, and echoing caverns, up windy slopes alight with gorse bushes, and across the shoulders of heathery mountains, along giddy ridges, and down, down, down again into wild valleys, and out into the acres of blue flowers. It was nearly midday when they found themselves looking down a deep hillside of a castle. A little toy castle it looked from where they stood, which seemed to be all pointed towers. But the lion was rushing down at a speed that it grew larger every moment, and before they had time to ask themselves what it was, they were already on level with it. And now it was no longer looked like a toy castle, but rose frowning in front of them. No face looked ever over the battlements, and the gates were shut fast. Aslan, not at all slacking his pace, rushed straight as a bullet towards it. "The witch is home," he cried out. "Now, children, hold on tight." The next moment, the whole world seemed to turn upside down, and the children felt as if they had left their insides behind them, for the lion had gathered himself up for a greater leap than any he had made yet, and jumped, or you might call his flying rather than jumping, right over the castle wall. The two girls, breathless but unhurt, found themselves tumbling off his back in the middle of a wide stone courtyard full of statues. Chapter 16. "What an extraordinary place," Lucy cried. "All these stone animals and people, too. It's like a museum." "Hush," said Susan. "Aslan's doing something." He was indeed. He had bounded up to the stone lion and breathed on him. Then without warning, or with waiting a moment, he whisked around, almost as if he had been a cat chasing his tail, and breathed also on the stone dwarf, which, as you remember, was standing a few feet from the lion with his back to it. Then he pounced on a tall stone dryad which stood behind the dwarf, turning rapidly aside to deal with a stone rabbit on his right, and then rush on to two centaurs. But at that moment Lucy said, "Susan, look! Look at the lion! I expect you've seen someone put a lighted match to a bit of newspaper which is propped up in a grate against an unlit fire. For a second nothing seems to have happened, and then you notice tiny streak of flame creeping along the edge of the newspaper. It was like that now. For a second after Aslan had breathed upon him, the stone lion looked just the same. Then a tiny streak of gold began to run along his white marbled back, and then it spread, and the color seemed to lick all over him as the flame licks all over the bit of the paper. Then, while his hindquarters were still obviously stone, the lion shook his mane and all the heavy stone folds rippled into living hair. Then he opened a great red mouth, warm and living, and gave a prodigious yawn. Then his hind legs came to life. He lifted one of them and scratched himself. Having caught sight of Aslan, he went bounding after him and frisking around him, whimpering with delight and jumping up to lick his face. Of course, the children's eyes turned to follow the lion, but the sight they saw was so wonderful that they had soon forgot about him. Everywhere the statues were coming to life. The courtyard looked no longer like a museum, but more like a zoo. Creatures were running after Aslan and dancing around him till he was almost hidden in the crowd. Instead of all that deadly white, the courtyard was now a blaze of color. Glossy chestnut sides of centaurs, indigo horns of unicorns, dazzling plumage of birds, ruddy brown of foxes, dogs, and satyrs, yellow stockings and crimson hoods of doors, and the birch girls in silver, the beech girls in fresh, transparent green, and the larch girls a green so bright that it was almost yellow. Indeed, instead of the deadly silence, the whole place rang with the sound of happy roarings, brayings, yelpings, barkings, squealings, cooings, neighings, stamping, shouts, hurrahs, songs, and laughter. "Oh," said Susan in a different tone, "look, is it safe?" Lucy looked and saw that Aslan had just breathed on the feet of a stone giant. "It's all right," shouted Aslan joyously. "Once the feet are put right, all the rest of him will follow." "That wasn't exactly what I meant," whispered Susan to Lucy. But it was too late to do anything about it now, even if Aslan had listened to her. The change was already creeping up the giant's legs. Now he was moving his feet. A moment later, he lifted the club off his shoulder, rubbed his eyes, and said, "Oh, bless me, I must have been asleep. Now where's that dreaded little witch that was running around the ground? Somewhere just by my feet, it was." But when everyone had shouted up to him and explained what had really happened, and when the giant had put his hand to his ear and got them to repeat it all again so that at last he understood, he then bowed down till his head was no further off of them than the top of a haystack and touched his cap repeatedly to Aslan, beaming all over his honest, ugly face. Giants of any sort are now so rare in England that, and so few giants are good-tempered, that 10 to 1 you have never seen a giant with his face beaming. It's a sight worth looking at. "Now for the inside of the house," said Aslan. "Look alive, everyone, upstairs and downstairs and in my lady's chamber. Leave no corner unsearched. You never know where some poor prisoner may be concealed." And into the interior they all rushed, and for several minutes the whole of that dark, horrible, fusty old castle echoed with the openings of windows and with everyone's voices crying out at once, "Don't forget the dungeons! Give us a hand with the door! Here's another little winding stair! Oh, I say, here's a poor kangaroo! Call Aslan! Phew, it smells in here! Look out for trapdoors! Up here! There's a whole lot more on the landing!" But the best of all was when Lucy came rushing upstairs, shouting out, "Aslan, Aslan, I found Mr. Tumnus. Do come quick." A moment later, Lucy and the little fawn were holding each other by both hands and dancing round and round for joy. The little chap was none the worse for having been a statue, and was, of course, very interested in all she had to tell him. But at last, the ransacking of the witch's fortress was ended. The whole castle stood empty, with every door and window open, and the light and the sweet spring air flooding in to all the dark and evil places which needed them so badly. The whole crowd of liberated statues surged back into the courtyard, and it was then that someone, Tumnus, I think, first said, "But how are we going to get out?" For Aslan had to get in by jumping, and the gates were still locked. "That'll be all right," said Aslan. And then, rising on his hind legs, he bawled up to the giant. "Hi, you up there," he roared. "What's your name?" "Giant Rumblebuffin, if you please, your honor," said the giant, once more touching his cap. "Well then, Giant Rumblebuffin," said Aslan, "just let us out of this, will you?" "Certainly, your honor, it will be my pleasure," he said. Stand well away from the gates, all ye little uns. Then he strode up to the gate himself, and bang, bang, bang went the huge club. The gates creaked with the first blow, cracked with the second, and shivered with the third. Then he tackled the towers on each side of them, and after a few minutes of crashing and thudding, both the towers and a good bit of the wall on each side went thundering down in a mass of hopeless rubble. When the dust cleared, it was odd, standing in that dirty, grim, stony courtyard to see through the gap all the grass and waving trees and sparkling streams of the forest, and blue hills beyond them, and then beyond them that the sky. "Blowed if I ain't all in a mucked sweat," said the giant, puffing like the largest railway engine. "Come of being out of condition. I suppose neither of you young ladies has such a thing as a pocket handkerchief about ye." "Yes, I have," said Lucy, standing on tiptoes and holding up her handkerchief as far as she could reach. "Oh, thank you, missy," said the giant, stooping down. The next moment, Lucy got rather afraid, for she found herself caught up in midair between the giant's finger and thumb. But just as she was getting near his face, he suddenly started and then put her gently back on the ground, muttering, "Oh, bless me, I picked up the little girl instead. I beg your pardon, missy, I thought you were the handkerchief." "Oh, no, no," said Lucy, laughing. "Here it is." This time he managed to get it, but it was only about the same size to him as a saccharine tablet would be to you, so that when she saw him solemnly rubbing it to and fro across his great red face, she said, "I'm afraid it might not be of much use to you, Mr. Rumblebuffin." "Not at all, not at all," said the giant politely. "Never met a nicer handkerchief. So fine, so handy, so, well, I don't know how to describe it." "What a nice giant he is," said Lucy to Mr. Tumnus. "Oh, yes," replied the fawn. "All of the Buffins always were one of the most respected of all the giant families in Narnia. Not very clever, perhaps. I never knew a giant that was. But an old family, with traditions, you know. If you'd been the other sort, she'd might have turned him into stone. She might have never turned him into stone." At this point, Aslan clapped his paws together and called for silence. "Our day's work is not yet over," he said. "If the witch is to be finally defeated before bedtime, we must find the battle at once." "And join in, I hope, sir," said the largest of the centaurs. "Oh, of course," said Aslan. "And now, those who can't keep up, that is, children, dwarves, small animals, must ride on the backs of those who can, that is, lions, centaurs, unicorns, horses, giants, and eagles. Those who are good with their hooves, noses must come in the front with us lions to smell out where the battle is. Look lively and sort yourselves." And with a great deal of bustle and cheering they did. The most pleased of the lot was the other lion, who kept running about everywhere pretending to be very busy, but really, in order to say to everyone he met, "Did you hear what he said? Us lions. That meant him and me. Us lions. That's what I like about Aslan. No sigh, no standoffishness. Us lions. That meant him and me." At least he went on saying this till Aslan had loaded him up with three dwarves, one dryad, two rabbits, and a hedgehog. That steadied him just a bit. When all were ready, it was a big sheepdog who actually helped Aslan most in getting them stored into their proper order. They all set out through the gap in the castle wall. At first, the lions and dogs went nosing about in all directions, but suddenly one great hound picked up the scent and gave a bay. There was no time lost after that. Soon all the dogs and lions and wolves and other hunting animals were going at full speed with their noses to the ground. All the others, streaked out for about half a mile behind them, were following as fast as they could. The noise was like an English fox hunt, only better, because every now and then, with the music of the hounds, was mixed the roar of the other lion, and sometimes the far deeper and far and more awful roar of Aslan himself. Faster and faster they went, as the scent became easier and easier to follow. And then, just as they came to the last curve in a narrow, winding valley, Lucy heard, above all those noises, another noise, a different one, which gave her a queer feeling inside. It was the noise of shouts and shrieks and of clashing of metal against metal. Then they came out of the narrow valley, and at once she saw the reason. There stood Peter and Edmund and all the rest of Aslan's army fighting desperately against a crowd of horrible creatures whom she had seen last night. Only now, in the daylight, they looked even stranger and more evil and more deformed. There also seemed to be far more of them. Peter's army, which had their backs to her, looked terribly few. And there were statues dotted all over the battlefield, or so apparently the witch had been using her wand. But she did not seem to be using it now. She was fighting with her stone knife. It was Peter she was fighting, both of them going at it so hard that Lucy could hardly make out what was happening. She only saw the stone knife and Peter's sword flashing so quickly that they looked like three knives and three swords. That pair was in the center of everything. On each side of the line stretched out. Horrible things were happening wherever she looked. "Off my back, children," shouted Aslan, and off they tumbled. Then, with a roar that shook all of Narnia from the western lamppost to the shores of the eastern sea, the great beast flung himself upon the White Witch. Lucy saw her face lifted toward him for 1 second with an expression of terror and amazement. But with the witch underneath, and at the same moment, all warlike creatures whom Aslan had led from the witch's house rushed madly on the enemy lines, dwarves with their battle axes, dogs with teeth, giant with his club and his feet also crushing dozens of the foes, unicorns with their horns, centaurs and with swords and hoofs, and Peter's tired army cheered and the newcomers roared, and the enemy squealed and gibbered till the wood re-echoed with the din of that onset. Chapter 17. The battle was all over a few minutes after their arrival. Most of the enemy had been killed in the first charge of Aslan and his companions. And when those who were still living saw that the White Witch was dead, they either gave themselves up or took to flight. The next thing that Lucy knew was that Peter and Aslan were shaking hands. It was strange to her to see Peter looking as he looked now. His face was so pale and stern, and he seemed to be so much older. "It was all Edmund's doing," Aslan Peter was saying. "We would have been beaten if it hadn't been for him. The witch was turning our troops into stone right and left, but nothing would stop him. He fought his way through three ogres to where she was just turning one of your leopards into a statue. And when he reached her, he had sense to bring a sword smashing down on her wand instead of trying to go for her directly, simply getting made into stone himself for his pains. That was the mistake all the rest were making. Once her wand was broken, we began to have some chance, if we hadn't lost so many already. He was terribly wounded. We must go and see him." They found Edmund in charge of Mrs. Beaver, a little way back from the fighting line. He was covered with blood, his mouth was open, and his face a nasty green color. "Quick, Lucy," said Aslan. And then, almost for the first time, Lucy remembered that precious cordial that had been given to her at Christmas, for a Christmas present. Her hands trembled so much that she could hardly undo the stopper, but she managed it and in the end poured a few drops into her brother's mouth. "There are other people wounded," said Aslan, while she was still looking eagerly at Edmund's pale face and wondering if it would even work. "Yes, I know," said Lucy crossly. "Wait just a minute." "Daughter of Eve," said Aslan in a graver voice, "others also are at the point of death. Must more people die for Edmund?" "I'm sorry, Aslan," said Lucy, getting up and going with him. For the next half hour they were busy. She attended to the wounded while he restored those who had been turned into stone. When at last she was free to come back to Edmund, she found him standing on his feet and not only healed of his wounds, but looking better than she had ever seen him look. Oh, for ages, in fact. For the first time. Since his first term at the horrid school, which was where he had begun to go wrong. He had become his real old self again and could look you in the face. And there on the field of battle, Aslan made him a knight. "Does he know," whispered Lucy to Susan, "that what Aslan did for him? Does he know what the arrangement with the witch was?" "Hush, no, of course not," said Susan. "Shouldn't he be told?" Lucy asked. "Surely not," said Susan. "It would be too awful for him. Think how you'd feel if you were him." "All the same, I think he ought to know," said Lucy. But at that moment they were interrupted. That night they slept where they were. How Aslan provided food for all of them, I don't know. But somehow or other they found themselves all sitting down on the grass to a fine high tea at about 8 o'clock. Next day they began marching eastward down the side of the great river, and the next day, after that, at about tea time, they actually reached the mouth. The castle of Cair Paravel was on its little hill towering up above them. Before them were the sands with rocks and little pools of salt water and seaweed, and the smell of the sea and long miles of bluish-green waves breaking over forever and ever on the beach. And oh, the cry of the seagulls. Have you heard it? Can you remember what it sounds like? That evening after tea, the four children all managed to get down to the beach again and get their shoes and stockings off and feel the sand between their toes. But the next day was more solemn. For then, in the great hall of Cair Paravel, that wonderful hall with the ivory roof and the west hall hung with peacock's feathers and the eastern door, which looks towards the sea, in the presence of all their friends and the sound of the trumpets, Aslan solemnly crowned them and led them to the four thrones, amid the deafening shouts of "Long live King Peter, long live Queen Susan, long live King Edmund, long live Queen Lucy." Once a king or queen of Narnia, always a king or queen. Bear it well, sons of Adam. Bear it well, daughters of Eve, said Aslan. Through the eastern door, which was wide open, came the voices of the mermen and the mermaids swimming close to the shore, singing in honor of their new kings and queens. So the children sat on their thrones, and scepters were put in their hands, and they gave rewards and honors to all their friends, to Tumnus the Fawn, to the beavers, giant Rumblebuffin, to the leopards, the good centaurs, the good dwarfs, and to the lion. That night there was a great feast in Cair Paravel, and revelry and dancing, and gold flashed and wine flowed, answering to the music inside, but stranger and sweeter and more piercing came the music of the sea people. Amid all those rejoicing, Aslan himself quietly slipped away, and when the kings and queens noticed that he wasn't there, they said nothing about it, for Mr. Beaver had warned them. "He'll be coming and going," he had said. "One day you'll see him, and another you won't. He doesn't like being tied down, and of course he has other countries to attend to. It's quite all right. He'll drop in often. Only you mustn't press him. He's wild, you know, not like a tame lion." Now, as you see, the story is nearly but not quite at an end. Those two kings and two queens governed Narnia well, and long and happy was their reign. At first, much of their time was spent in seeking out the remnants of the White Witch's army and destroying them. Indeed, for a long time, there would be news of evil things lurking in the wilder parts of the forests. A haunting here, a killing there, a glimpse of a werewolf one month and a rumor of a hag the next. But in the end, all that foul brood was stomped out. And they had made good laws and kept the peace and saved good trees from being unnecessarily cut down, liberating young dwarves and young satyrs from being sent to school, generally stopping busybodies and interferers, and encouraged ordinary people who wanted to live and let live. And they drove back the fierce giants, quite a different sort from giant Rumblebuffin, to the north of Narnia when these ventured across the frontier. They entered into friendships and alliances with countries beyond the sea, paid them visits of state, and received visits of state from them. They themselves grew and changed as the years passed over them. Peter became a tall and deep-chested man and a great warrior. He was called Peter the Magnificent. Susan grew into a tall and gracious woman with black hair that fell almost to her feet, and the kings of the countries beyond the sea began to send ambassadors asking for her hand in marriage. She was called Susan the Gentle. Edmund was a graver and quieter man than Peter, and great in counsel and judgment. He became known as Edmund the Just. But as for Lucy, she was always gay and golden-haired, and all princes in those parts desired her to be their queen. Her own people called her Queen Lucy the Valiant. So they lived in great joy, and if ever they remembered their life in this world, it was only as one remembers a dream. One year it fell out that Tumnus, who was now a middle-aged fawn and beginning to become stout, came down the river and brought them news that the white stag had once more appeared in his parts. The white stag who would give you wishes if you caught him. So those two kings and two queens with the principal members of their court rode a-hunting with horns and hounds to the western wood to follow the white stag. They had not hunted long before they had a sight of him. He led them at a great pace over rough and smooth and through thick and thin, till the horses of all the courtiers were tired out, and only those four were still following. They saw the stag enter into a thicket where their horses couldn't follow. Then King Peter said, for they talked in quite a different style now, having been kings and queens for so long, "Fair consorts, let us now alight from our horses and follow this beast into the thicket, for in all my days I never hunted a noble quarry." "Sir," said the others, "even so let us do." So they alighted and tied their horses to trees and went on into the thick forest on foot. As soon as they had entered it, Queen Susan said, "Friends, here is a great marvel, for I seem to see a tree of iron." "Madam," said King Edmund, "if you look well upon it, you shall see that it's a pillar of iron with a lantern set on the top thereof." "By the lion's mane, a strange device," said Peter, "to set a lantern where the trees cluster so thick and about it and so high above it, as if it were to lit, it should give light to no man." "Sir," said Lucy, "by likelihood, when this post and this lamp were set here, there were smaller trees in this place, or much fewer, or even none at all, for this is a young wood, and the iron post is old." And they stood looking at it. Then King Edmund said, "I know not how it is, but this lamp on the post worketh upon me strangely. It runs in my mind that I have seen the like before, as it were in a dream, or in the dream of a dream." "Sir," they all answered, "it's even with us, too." "And more," said Queen Lucy, "for it will not go out of my mind that if we pass this post and lantern, either we shall find strange adventures or some great change of our fortunes." "Madam," said King Edmund, "the like foreboding stirreth in my heart also." "And in mine, fair brother," said Peter. "And mine too," said Susan. "Wherefore, by counsel, we shall lightly return to our horses and follow this white stag no further." "Madam," said Peter, "therein I pray thee to have me excused, for never since we four were kings and queens in Narnia have we set our hand to any high matter, as battles, quests, feasts of arms, acts of justice, and the like, and then given over, but always we have taken it in hand, the same way we have achieved." "Sister," said Lucy, "my royal brother speaks rightly, and it seems to me we should be shamed if we, for fear of foreboding, we turn back from following so noble a beast as now we have in chase." "And so say I," said Edmund, "and I have such a desire to find the signification of this thing that I would not, by my good will, turn back for the richest jewel in all Narnia and in all the islands." "Then, in the name of Aslan," said Susan, "if ye will all have it so, let us go on and take the adventure that shall fall to us." So the kings and queens entered the thicket, and before they had gone a score of paces, they all remembered that the thing that they had seen was called a lamppost. And before they had gone twenty more, they noticed that they were making their way through branches, not through branches, but through coats. And the next moment they all came tumbling out of the wardrobe into the empty room. They were no longer kings and queens in their hunting arrays, but just Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy in their old clothes. It was the same day and the same hour of the day on which they had all gone into the wardrobe to hide. Mrs. MacCready and the visitors were still talking in the passage, but luckily they never came into the empty room, and so the children weren't caught. And that would have been the very end of the story, if it had been that they felt they really must explain to their professor why four of the coats out of his wardrobe were missing. And the professor, who was a very remarkable man, didn't tell them not to be silly or not to tell lies, but believed the whole story. "No," he said, "I don't think it will be any good trying to go back through the wardrobe to get the coats. You won't get into Narnia again by that route. Nor would the coats be much use now, if you did, huh?" "Well, it's that. Yes, of course, you'll get back to Narnia again someday. Once a king in Narnia, always a king in Narnia. But don't go trying to use the same route twice. Indeed, don't try to get there at all. It'll happen when you're not looking for it. And don't talk too much about it, even amongst yourself. You don't mention it to anyone else unless you find that they've had adventures of the same sort themselves.
What's that? How will you know? Oh, you'll know, all right. Odd things, they say. Even their looks will let out the secret out. Keep your eyes open. Bless me, what do they teach these kids in schools these days? And that is the very end of the adventure in the wardrobe. But if the professor was right, it was only the beginning of the adventures in Narnia.